This class is the reasons for anti-Semitism. And let me start, first of all, with just a little bit of a description of why we should be looking at anti-Semitism as any type of phenomenon for study. You know, what's so unique about it? You know, people hate each other. It's not uncommon. The Turks hate the Armenians, massacred them. In Yugoslavia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and all these areas, there are people who hate each other, have hated each other for thousands of years, hundreds of years at least. It's not uncommon to find hatred. And unfortunately, tragically, it's not uncommon. What is it about anti-Semitism that deserves a further look? So I think there are four features of anti-Semitism, which means the hatred of Jews, although technically a Semite is not only a Jew, because it refers to Arabs as well, but generally we use the term anti-Semitism to talk about hatred of Jews specifically. And there are, you know, plenty of Arab anti-Semites. There are actually some Jewish anti-Semites as well. So you could be a Semite and still hate Jews. It's nothing to do with the Semitic aspect of it. So what I'm defining anti-Semitism as Jew hatred, if you prefer to use the term Jew hatred, you could do so. Anti-Semitism is the more common terminology that we use. So the four factors that I would say, cause us to take a second look and to look at this in more depth are the following. There's one in the LCD projector bag.
Where is that?
The bag with the LCD projector.
There is, you know what that is.
Okay. So now, what are the four factors? The first is universality of anti-Semitism. That means it comes from all sides. Woody Allen was sent by his parents to interfaith camp, and there he was beaten equally by people of all races and creeds. Right? And really the idea here is that pretty much all races and creeds have had something against us. It's quite amazing. Starting with pagans, like the Romans and the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Amalekites, and in ancient history, pagans have hated the Jews. Of course, you've got Christians who've hated the Jews. You know, we've had thousands of years of Christian anti-Semitism going all the way back to Constantine banning the Jews from entering the city of Jerusalem through to St. John Chrysostom, who called the Crusade. Well, get there. Right, St. John Chrysostom, right? St. John Chrysostom, who, of course, called the synagogue a den of thieves and vipers, a house of prostitutes. We have the Crusaders who came from France and England and went to Israel and said, if we're going to Israel to rid the land of the Muslims, what about the heretics in our midst, and proceeded to kill thousands of Jews during the Crusades. We have the Inquisition, and we have pogroms, and this anti-Semitism did not come from the mobs. It didn't come from the common people. Right? There were leaders who were preaching these type of things. I recommend reading the book by James Carroll, Sword of Constantine, that goes into detail regarding the horrible history of the Christian attitude to the Jews, and not just that, but detailing its origin in the very depth of Christian theology, and they call replacement theology, that the chosen people were replaced by the Christians, and that the horrors that wreaked upon the Jewish people throughout history were indeed. So it was pagans, and then of course it was Christians who were anti-pagans. That in common, there was anti-Semitism in both. Just the very fact, I mean, just when you think of the depth of the feeling towards Jews, an attitude would be the papal nuncio in Romania, that's the Pope's ambassador in Romania during the Second World War, was approached by Rabbi Weissmandl. Rabbi Weissmandl was a man who did a lot of work to save the Jews in Europe from the Nazis. And he came to the papal nuncio's office on a Sunday, and he demanded to see the nuncio. And the secretary said, sorry, he cannot see you, it's Sunday. He pushed past the secretary, burst into the office, and the nuncio said, I don't deal with profane matters on Sunday. So Rabbi Weissmandl said, profane matters? The blood of thousands, 3,000 innocent children is a profane matter? And the papal nuncio said, what do you mean innocent children? He said, there are 3,000 Jewish children going to be sent to a concentration camp if you don't intervene. He said, but they're Jewish children. That's not innocent blood. Innocent blood? Not innocent. Because what does it say in Matthew? His blood be upon us and upon our children. And that terrible verse has meant that they have viewed our blood as indeed guilty. And so we've had it from the pagans and the Christians. The Muslims? Muslims are monotheists. They're not pagans. They're not Christians. They're monotheists. Well, we've certainly had anti-Semitism from there. The Jews were second-class citizens in every Islamic country. The leader of the Jewish community had to pay jizya, which was a special tax the Jews had to pay. He would come to the Muslim leader, pay him the tax publicly. The Muslim leader would slap him to show the public humiliation and the fact that the Jews are under the rule of Islam. There was a blood libel in Damascus in 1880. There were pogroms in Hebron, Tel Aviv, beginning of last century. Muhammad beheaded 800 Jewish men in Arabia and then took the women and children as slaves and then expelled the rest of the Jews from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. Is there anti-Semitism there? I suppose. Did it stop with people who are anti-religions? We've got pagans, we've got Muslims, we've got Christians. What about people who are anti-religion? The Enlightenment. French philosophers of the Enlightenment. What was their attitude? Well, if you look at the Dictionnaire Philosophique of Voltaire, the Voltaire's philosophical dictionary under the entry Jews, very, very fascinating little discussion there. The Jews, he says, are the most unique of all people and certainly the most contemptible. They have no philosophy of their own. It's stolen. Their God is money. I mean, he just goes through this whole long attack on the Jews. He ends the article with, still, we ought not to burn them. That makes him a liberal. That's very nice. Right? So, but yes, still, we ought not to burn them. So even in the Enlightenment, and by the way, those who said during that time to give us equal rights, that was with a condition. There was a condition attached. Napoleon was quoted as saying, to the Jews as Jews, nothing. To the Jews as Frenchmen, everything. Because when do we deserve equal rights and citizenship, etc., etc.? As long as we abandon our identity as Jews. So to give us equal rights, but to demand that we abandon our identity as Jews, I think that's also anti-Semitism. Did we get it only from the Enlightenment? There was anti-law. What about from the left, the right, the politics? Well, from the left is communism. Communism was never much of a friend to the Jews. Despite the fact of all the Jews who were involved in the creation of communism, Karl Marx, etc., etc., it was an anti-Semitic doctrine. There was a hatred for the Jews. I mean, there was a special section of the Communist Party, the Yevsektia, which was composed of people who were there to root out Judaism and Jewish practice. It was illegal. Pre-Glasnost Soviet Union, you're not allowed to teach anyone under 18 religion. There was a Jewish refusenik who was arrested and put in prison for possessing a book called Elef Milim, 1,000 words. It's a Hebrew grammar book. Seditious, 1,000 words. There was a Soviet anti-Zionist committee. It was, this type of things were illegal. Prayer and things, I mean, granted they were against religion in general, but there was a special attempt at wiping out Judaism. Well, that's the communists. What about the extreme right? We don't have to go further than the Nazis to know that the extreme right, the fascists, hate the Jews with greater passion, if anything, than the left. So the first unique feature of anti-Semitism is universality. From the pagans, the Christians, the Muslims, the Enlightenment, the left, the right, the center, capitalists, communists. Who was a greater capitalist than Henry Ford? Henry Ford, of course, sponsored the Dearborn Independent, which was a newspaper that spread anti-Semitism. It published Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a forgery written by a member of the Russian Secret Service that accused the Jews of a national conspiracy. to take over the world. Henry Ford was a great believer in that. So yeah, it was capitalists, it was communists, left, right, center, etc. So that's the first factor, universality. The second is intensity. There are many hatreds, but not all of them, most of them, do not feature a desire to totally annihilate every single last member of that group that you hate. If the group would be living in New Zealand and you're in Albania, you don't really care. With the exception of anti-Semitism, here it was something which the intensity of it was led anti-Semites to want to eliminate every last Jew on the face of the planet. Man, women and child. Right, the Nazis in the 1C conference had lists of Jews and where they lived everywhere in the world. They knew how many Jews there were in New Zealand. Did they need New Zealand for Lebensraum, for living space for the Germans? Of course not. Why should they care if there are Jews in South America? Why? They wanted to wipe out every last Jew. There was the unspeakable intensity of the Chmielnytsky pogroms in Poland, Russia, in which Jews were mass. I mean, the tortures, I can't even repeat them. The horrific methods of killing people, the tortures they subjected them to, was just unbelievable. There was an intensity and an anger and a violence that went far beyond what one would expect just from an enemy in war. Look today, the Palestinians, the lynching of those two Israeli reservists, beating them to death and not content with that, mutilating their bodies, dragging them through the streets of Ramallah. I mean, the hatred, beating to death those two 14-year-old Jewish boys, remember them? Two 14-year-old Jewish boys on a hike. One of them the son of a good friend of mine, Kobe Mandel. Ambushing two 14-year-old boys, beating them to death with rocks. Their corpse was a difficulty for the mother to identify the corpse. The intensity of such hatred is incredible. It's hard to comprehend. That's the second feature, intensity. The third feature is longevity. How long has it been around? Long as the Jews. Egypt, Greece, Rome, all had it. Babylonians, Persians, the Medes. It continued through the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, the Renaissance period, into the modern period. It has not died out. It has not died out, and the modern period's been worse. So there's a certain longevity to this type of hatred, which is incredible. So, now, again, some of these features you will find in different types of hatred, but all of them combined? Universality, intensity, longevity. And number four is irrationality. The incredible irrationality of it. It makes no sense. You know, we are accused of killing God. That makes sense to you?
No.
How can you kill God if he doesn't want you to kill him? And if he does want you to kill him so he can die for your sins, then you're doing him a favor. Doing the world a favor. Had Jesus not died for anyone's sins, everyone would be burning in hell. And yet, we're accused of killing God. What does that mean, to kill God? How can God die? If he doesn't want to die, he won't die. And if he does die, it's because he wants to. And he knew he'd be resurrected. So some guy comes and says, shoot me. He's like, what, are you crazy? He says, it's okay, I'm God, I'll be resurrected in 3 days. I'm dying to expiate everyone's sins. It's not a problem, shoot me. You shoot him, and then everyone turns around and says, you sick murderer. But it's irrational. The whole idea is irrational. You ever heard of the blood libel? What is a blood libel? The blood libel spread by anti-Semites, Christians and Muslims, and by the way, the Muslims are still spreading it today, is that Jews use the blood of non-Jews, Christians, for our matzah. Yeah. I mean, it's so irrational, it's unbelievable. You know, to the extent that the code of Jewish law says, although ideally you should use red wine for the Passover Seder, to remind ourselves of the blood of the Jews that was spilt in Egypt, but Moshe Isserles, the great authority of Jewish law in Europe, said in our communities it is customary to use white wine so as not to bring the blood libel upon ourselves. And that's sad. So Jews here are using white wine. Why? We use red wine. The Christians would say, aha, there's Christian blood in that. My mother grew up in London before the Second World War. Yep, not a very religious family. And she had most of her friends were not Jewish. What was interesting, she told me, is that around Passover time, as it would approach Easter, which the Christians knew about, and they knew that Passover was around that time, they would not let her friends come to her house to play. So my mother's Christian friends would not come to her house to play around Passover time. Why? They never said it. But why suddenly around Passover they're not coming to her house to play and they play the role? Because they're scared that my mother would have, or her mother would have slaughtered them and used their blood for matzah. We were accused of this throughout history. There's another libel called torturing the host. You know what that is? That's not a guest who stays too long, right? What that is, torturing the host, is that the Catholics believe that the wafer in church and the wine turn into the body and the blood of Jesus, right? It's called the doctrine of transubstantiation. That the actual wafer is really the flesh of Jesus, in which they then eat. And so it's from the pagan cults of Rome, the cult of Mithras. Many, many pagan religions had this feature. They took it into Christianity. But again, what's interesting is Jewish communities were often accused of stealing the wafer from the church and torturing it. Yeah, and witnesses would come forth and say they saw the Jews sticking pins into the wafer and they could hear the baby Jesus crying as the Jews did that. So we laugh about it because it's so insane. You know, we're torturing a cookie, right? But we may laugh, but there were pogroms. Our ancestors were killed and tortured because of the accusation of torturing the wafer. How irrational could it be? How rational could it be? You know, the exaggerated influence of the Jews. The Jews control everything. Everything. You know, people believe this. The very often also anti-Semitism was so irrational that it was against the best interest of the anti-Semite. You know, the rejection of Jewish physics by Germany. Rejection of what they call Jewish physics by the Soviet Union. There were many, many things the Soviet Union believed in because, official line believed in certain things because the alternative scientifically was done by Jewish scientists. So forget it. Egypt refused the Salk vaccine against polio. Why? Who was Jonas Salk? He was Jewish. Then I watched certain movies because Barbara Streisand's in them. I can understand that. But not because of the same reason. Right? That's because she's Jewish, right? It makes no sense. It's irrational. So these are four features that in my mind make anti-Semitism worthy of study. It's a very strange phenomenon. It's universality, intensity, longevity, and irrationality of it. Now, what are some of the explanations which have been given for this hatred? What are some of the explanations? So there are four main schools of thought, I think, in trying to explain this. I think they're all wrong. There may be elements of truth in some of them, but as a total explanation, I think they're wrong.
Are they given by Jews or
non-Jews? Both. Jews can be wrong as well. Not me, but others. Okay. So now, here are some of the explanations. First of all, the scapegoat explanation. You know, the explanation which is, look, everyone needs a scapegoat. You've got to blame someone. Your team loses, the coach gets fired. Right, you know, something goes wrong in the company. Okay, you get fired. Whatever, there's always a scapegoat. People like scapegoats. Of course, the problem with that answer is, but why is it always the same scapegoat? You know, some guy in the company, he gets demoted the first time something goes wrong. Right, something else goes wrong, totally different department, he gets demoted again. Something goes wrong in a totally different department, he gets demoted again. Something goes wrong again, he gets thrown out of the company. They rehire him, something else goes wrong, he gets thrown out again. I mean, every time, the same guy. Why should Greeks, Romans, right, pagans, communists, Christians, and Muslims always have choose the same scapegoat? There's no one else as a scapegoat. Can't blame anyone else. It also doesn't explain why it also is there even in good times. When things were going well, when the church was ascendant, when Islam ruled, right, when things were going well for them, but the new scapegoat for? Things going fine. The second explanation is economics. It's because the Jews were into money lending. And that's why they hate us. The Shylock type thing. Well, why did Jews lend money? Why did Jews go into banking? The answer is very simple. First of all, we were not allowed to join trade guilds in Europe. So that means we could not operate in any of the trades or professions. Why couldn't we join trade guilds? Because they're anti-Semites. They wouldn't let us join. We were not allowed to own land in Europe. Why? Because the governments were anti-Semitic. They wouldn't let us own land. We are only allowed to live in the ghetto, which made it difficult to make a living if you're only living in one, you're confined to one area to live. Right? Often Jewish doctors were not allowed to treat Christian patients. Right? So, and the church would not allow anyone Christian to lend money with interest. So, therefore, why did the Jews lend money? Because of anti-Semitism. In other words, anti-Semitism did not begin because we lent money. We were lending money because there was anti-Semitism. Understand what I'm saying? They're putting the cause, the effect before the cause. And since we're not talking about quantum physics here, you can't do that. You can put the cause before, you have to put the cause before the effect. And the fact is, to say that the economic stereotype caused anti-Semitism is ridiculous, because the reason there was any type of economic stereotype is only because there was anti-Semitism that forced us into that economic niche. And by the way, it can't explain it. Economics, some people say, because the Jews are rich. But the truth is, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. Right? The fact that we are one of the highest income groups in the United States is fairly unique to this century. For in Europe, for example, the Jews in Poland and Lithuania were dirt poor. I would not say poor as a church mouse. That would be an inappropriate metaphor. Right? But they were poor. We were very poor. Right? Lithuania, Poland, Russia... We were forced into the pales of sediment. We were poor.
Rabbi, how did they lend money if they were poor?
No, but that's Jews in other parts. In Western Europe, the Jews were wealthier. But as a class, I mean, what I'm saying is Poland, Jews were very poor. They were not the money lenders, etc. And yet there was tremendous anti-Semitism. So I'm saying there's been in all areas. Okay, so you've got to give me an explanation that's true for all of them, right? That would be the simplest, most elegant explanation, is something that will explain all the phenomena as opposed to just here and there. So that's economics. A third explanation is psychological. That is to say, it's a psychological aberration. It's like a sickness. It seems to me, though, that a sickness that afflicts young, old, pagans, atheists, saints, communists, capitalists, anxious, moderns, men, women, rich and poor, is no longer a sickness. It's a phenomenon you have to explain. Now, just calling it a sickness or not doesn't change the thing. Like the AMA decided at one point in history that, or the American Psychological Association decided at some point in history that homosexuality was not normal, right? And then they made a decision that it was okay and it was normal. So that doesn't change the reality. Whether it's normal or not is not based on a vote by the AMA or something like that, right? And I'm saying whether it is normal or not, just it's not, the vote doesn't make the difference. So, but to say that something is an aberration, but everyone's got, I mean, the diversity of people who have it, right, means it's no longer an aberration, it has to be understood as a phenomenon. So it's just labelling, it's not explanation. And then some people say that the chosen people is what has caused, the fact that we believe we're the chosen people, that causes anti-Semitism. I mean, the Jews believe, there's a chutzpah, can you imagine that? We believe we're the chosen people. There are how many Jews in the world? 14 million, something like that, about 14 million Jews in the world. How many non-Jews are there in the world? 6 billion. Right. What does the word Gentile mean, by the way?
Non-Jew.
Yeah.
Pagan?
Isn't that bizarre? All right, Gentile generally is understood meaning a non-Jew. It's a little bizarre to say that 99.999% of the world's population is defined as being not Jewish. It's incredible, right? It's defining all the stars and galaxies, not Earth. That's not Earth. My wing is not Earth. It's a star. There's more stars than Earth. Not Earth. Right, very strange. But they say we've got an incredulous arrogance. We call ourselves the chosen people. That's why there's anti-Zionism. My response to that is, which nation doesn't think they're the chosen people?
Israel?
Are there any nations that look at themselves and say, oh, we're the worst? We're just pathetic. Right? I mean, look at it. You know, it's a rhetorical question, right? But I mean, which nations? You look at ask the Italians, which is the best nation in the world? That's it, the Italians? We produce Da Vinci, we produce Michelangelo, the artwork, the architecture, the food, pasta, right? You name it. We did it. We're the greatest. You ask the French, who are the greatest people in the world? They'll say France. Everyone else is barbarians. Well, what do you mean? Look at the French food. Look at French wine. Look at our arts, our literature. Look at all this. France, the beauty of the French language. Ask Greeks. Who is the chosen people? They say Greeks. Pythagoras, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, Telesivalis, right? Stephanopoulos. I mean, I don't know. Why did he say... There's been no famous Greeks since Aristotle died. You know what I mean? That's it. Right? But they'll say, yeah, we're the chosen people. We're the greatest. Ask China. Ask in Japan. Japan refers to us as Gaijin. Gaijin foreigners. It's like a derogatory term. Everyone thinks they're the chosen people. The only people who get hit for it are who?
Israel.
The Jews. That's right. Right? You know, who's not chosen? Who's not chosen? Right, so to say that because of the... And by the way, the doctrine of the chosen people in Judaism, what are we chosen for? We are chosen as priests of mankind. We are here to serve all of humanity. That is to say, to act in such a way that we can help elevate all of humanity to a greater moral and spiritual level. We're not chosen people because we want to rule over humanity, and we don't look forward to the days of the Messiah, and say that's the time when we'll rule. We'll have slaves and this and this and that. No, it's a time that we look forward to that everyone will recognize God, and everyone will be on a high moral level. We don't even have a doctrine that if you're not Jewish, you're going to burn forever. If you're a non-Jew who is sincere and moral, believes in God, keeps the basic moral laws, that's great. That's wonderful. We have no compulsion to go out and convert people. We're one of the only religions that doesn't feel the need to go out and convert people. You don't see rabbis and yeshiva students going door to door in some non-Jewish neighborhood. Hi, are you interested in Talmud class, sir? Do you have that? You ever see that? No. Right? We don't have outreach programs, right, for non-Jews. We don't come out and say, hi. Right, I'm in, whatever, right? Christians for Talmud, it's about the same as logical as Jews for Jesus, right? So come out and say, that's it, right? Come and join? No. Why do they want people to join? Because they believe that if you're not part of it, you're going to burn. We don't believe that. I much prefer a sincere non-Jew than an insincere Jew. So leave him, let him be non-Jewish. That's wonderful. Doesn't have to be Jewish. So therefore, there was an old record, Borscht Belt Catskill comedian called You Don't Have to Be Jewish. Anyone ever heard that? It was unbelievable. Okay, anyway, it's a great record. So, but that's the thing. We say you don't have to be Jewish. So our chosen people idea is the most benign and benevolent chosen people concept that there is in the world. And by the way, it's not racist because any race can become Jewish. You know, if you believe that the Aryans are it, you can't become an Aryan. You can't convert to being an Aryan. You know what I mean? You can't convert to being Italian. Either you are or you're not. You can't convert to being Japanese. Either you are or you're not. But anyone can become Jewish. So it's not race. It's ideology. And therefore, that cannot be a sufficient explanation for anti-Semitism. So we have four incorrect explanations. The scapegoat, economics, psychology, and the chosen people. And I think there are flaws in each of them. What are some of the correct explanations? I believe that there are the following. First of all, Jewish ideology, to a certain degree, has contributed to anti-Semitism. What do I mean by that? That the opposition to our ideology is one of the reasons there are anti-Semitism. For example, our ideology is not secret. Our ideology is that there is only one God, indivisible, unseen, unique. Now, what do we say to the pagans about their gods? Do Jews say, that's okay, that's true for you, this is true for me? No. What did Jews say? That is rubbish. The ram god Khnum of Egypt is just a ram. There, that's it. Right? We say that the pagan gods are meaningless rubbish. We are very open about that. That is offensive. What do you mean? You tell me I believe in nothingness? The Jew would say, yes. Yes, you do. We made no bones about it. The Romans said, put up a statue of Jupiter. We won the war. Put up a stupid statue. What's the big deal? The Jew said, no way. We'll die rather than put up a stupid statue. The Romans said, every other nation we conquered, right, immediately accepts our gods. Okay, so you'll have another god. Of course, pagans were more open-minded about it. Right, you've got 25 gods, you're conquered by the Greeks. Okay, we'll have another 15. But the Jews say, despite everything, one God, that's it. That ideology, and combined with the fact we believe there's an absolute morality, an absolute scale of what is right and wrong, is offensive to many people. Think of the, and the truth is, the intensity of the anti-Semitism is directly proportional to the ideological opposition. Listen again. The intensity of the anti-Semitism is directly proportional to the ideological opposition. Who is the most intense anti-Semitism we've ever seen in history? What would you say? I think the Nazis. And the Nazis, probably. The Nazis, probably the most intense we've ever experienced, we've ever seen. All right. Now, their ideological opposition was total. Because the Nazis did not believe there was an absolute right and wrong. They said, you know what? If it's good for Germany, that what makes it good. Doesn't matter what you have to do. Deutschland über alles. Deutschland over everything. Now that is the most direct ideological opposition to Jews. Because the Jewish people say, no. Good and evil over everything. God over everything. To say that there is no such thing, that torturing small children is acceptable if it advances the cause of Deutschland, is the Jewish people are radically opposed to that. And the Nazis felt that as long as there's one Jew around, that Jew will Judaize the world. That Jew will bring out some Jewish concept to the whole world. They had to eliminate every one of us. Because the Jews represent, in the words of, I think it was Hitler who said, that the Jews brought two blemishes on humanity. Conscience on the soul and circumcision on the flesh. They felt that we were weak because we had conscience. And indeed, we do represent that idea. We represent the concept of conscience, of absolute morality, of right and wrong. But the ideological opposition between us and the Nazis is very great. Christian anti-Semitism was very intense, but it wasn't as intense as the Nazis. Was not as intense as the Nazis. Because our ideological opposition is less so. We both believe in God. We both believe in absolute morality. We both believe in the world to come. We both believe in the idea of commandments in the Bible. There is opposition, certainly. Not as much as but our opposition is such that they see our existence keeping the Torah as a threat to them. So of course there is anti-Semitism. They say, if you're chosen, we're frozen. If we're chosen, you're frozen. Right? The 12 disciples, right? 12 apostles, they replace the 12 tribes. The new Israel is the church. So if the old Israel is sitting around learning, speaking Hebrew, learning the Bible, keeping the Torah, that's a problem. And that's why Christian anti-Semitism was great, not as great as Nazism, because the ideological opposition was not as great, but it was greater than Islam. Why? Because in Islam, they did not see us as replacing, they did not see themselves as replacing the chosen people. They did not see Jews keeping the Torah as a threat to Islam. But we felt that Muhammad was misrepresented. He was not a prophet. He was not even a scholar. The Quran is not divine. There's ideological opposition there. So the anti-Semitism. Who was the least, even less than the Muslims, the pagans? Pagans didn't really care that much. As long as we were paying our taxes, as long as we were loyal to the empire, they could have lived with that. So what I'm saying is, the ideological opposition is directly proportional to the degree of anti-Semitism. And consequently, one contributing cause would be the fact that the Jews very openly believe in a very specific, absolute set of morality and truth, and which is the exclusion of others. And consequently, there has been this type of anti-Semitism and hatred. I think a second factor is quality of life. The Jews have had a tremendous quality of life throughout the centuries. I don't mean by that that we've always been wealthy. We haven't. But even when we were poor, what did Jews have? You look at the Jewish family life throughout the centuries. You look at Jewish literacy throughout the centuries and compare it to the peoples around us. We always had a higher quality of life. In incredible ways. Jewish family life is legendary. It still is. The level of all types of violent crimes, substance abuse, problems amongst the Jewish community was always less than the surrounding communities. Our literacy was that our quality of life has been something which people have looked at and that has created jealousy. And the jealousy turns into one of two things. What does jealousy do? Either imitation or hatred. I will try to get it, and if I can't get it, you shouldn't have it either. You ever heard that? If I can't have it, you certainly can't have it. And so, illustrated, I think, beautifully in a cartoon by Gary Larson in The Far Side, in which he's got this caveman who sees this bird flying. And so the caveman gets out his stone tools and stuff, and you see him banging away, and he makes wings for himself. And he falls down. And he tries to fly with it with nothing. He takes out his stone tools again, he's hammering away, he takes out a bow and arrow, and he shoots down the bird. That's the progression. I want to fly too. Let's try and make wings, see if our wings get us to fly as high as the bird. They don't work. Okay, if I can't have it, you certainly cannot fly. So let's make a bow and arrow, shoot down the bird. That's the jealousy turning into imitation, and the unsuccessful imitations turning into hatred. And so a great degree of that has been the quality of Jewish life. And, by the way, the literacy, the family life, the low crime rate, the low substance abuse rate, these are directly can be directly attributed to the Torah. The reason we had such wonderful things, we had Shabbos. We had Shabbos, the beauty of Shabbos. We had the study of Torah, the mitzvah of Torah study, and the literacy that created, and the academic excellence that created, which is still true to this day, even amongst secular Jews. There's still the study ethic is very strong, which has come from that Torah study ethic. The third, I think, correct explanation is the otherness quality. That is to say, the fact that the Jewish people are different. We are different. There is a certain factor that, as Richard Wagner said in his essay on Jewry in music, he says, the Jew, who as everyone knows, has a God all to himself, no matter to what European nationality he belongs, has something disagreeably foreign to that nationality. We're always looked at as other. Other. We type of like these guys, the Coneheads. Anyone seen that? Right? The Coneheads, right? We're saying, people say, yeah, we're from Paris, right? Really, we're aliens. Belda, right? You know, but why do we have this otherness quality about us? Well, part of it is because we do remain separate. Part of Judaism is that we can only maintain the intensity of our ethical, moral, and spiritual message if we do not dilute that message by assimilation. And so therefore our laws separate us. We don't intermarry. We don't eat the same food. We don't rest on the same day. We are indeed different, and we actually encourage that difference. And indeed, the fact is that we also, there's a certain sense that we are from a different dimension of existence. It's almost as if we are people like a surprise that we're here still. You know, I mean, there's a certain lack of comfort with the fact that, what do you mean, these ancient people, Jews, and the fact there's a tremendous discomfort today with the fact that there's a state of Israel. You know, here's a state that's been around 50 years, and there are people still who question its legitimacy. No one questions the legitimacy of Rwanda, Bandar Begawan, you know, countries which are basically despotic dictatorships, in which the people are being murdered regularly, in which the government is basically a regime of just theft, you know, places like the Palestinian Authority. Israel, right, of the 15 elections in the Middle East in the past 3,300 years, all of them were in Israel. We have Arab members of parliament who hate Israel. We have communist members of parliament who hate Israel, right? The Arabs have the vote in Israel, right? We have we share the hospitals and the buses and everything else, right? And the only, and the legitimacy of Israel bothers people. Why? Ooh, what's going on? The Jews in Israel? I mean, that's an ancient thing. We should have been extinct long ago. What are we doing? Very disturbing to see this. It's like seeing an extinct dinosaur walking around your backyard. I'd be a little disturbed by that.
I was going to say, also, the Vatican does not recognize Israel.
Well, it recently did, just in the statement of understanding between the Holy See and Israel, but with many conditions. You are correct. Part of it is, it's a little disturbing, because the Vatican found the return of Jews to Israel to be a little disturbing. Because here we return to Israel, but we haven't yet accepted Jesus. What's going on? Aren't we supposed to be in exile until we accept him? And then we got even Jerusalem in 67 without accepting Jesus. What's going on? It's a good point you're making, right? Because there's a certain discomfort level in the Jews being around. Like, you know, people look at us and say, whoa, Jews? It's type of like a quality of otherness about us as a nation, which even when we try to assimilate, there is still the quality of otherness. Right. And that quality of otherness, of being from a different dimension, we are attached to a different dimension. We're attached to a spiritual dimension. That's why we're eternal. Because we have an eternal message, God made us an eternal people. Since we have an eternal message, he blessed us that we would always be around. But that has some negatives. One of the negatives is that if you are different, there's an automatic feeling that the different is there's a certain hatred there. And finally, it's a divine memo. It's a memo. It is a reminder to us very often. Very often anti-Semitism arises specifically at the moment where the Jews seem to be doing so well in the non-Jewish society. We seem to be doing great. The Golden Age of Spain. Golden Age of Spain, great scholarship, right? Poetry, art, economic advisors, science, boom, Inquisition. Jews are doing okay in Western Europe. The emancipation and the Enlightenment had let Jews into universities, into the sciences, into poetry, into all the field. Boom! Anti-Semitism hits Nazism. That very often in history, it has been a way in which we are reminded of who we really are. We are reminded because we begin to forget sometimes. We get too comfortable. And when we get so comfortable, we forget why we are here and our task in the world, which is really the Torah. And when we forget about the Torah, very often, people rise up to remind us. Is that their intent? When the anti-Semite gets up, the Cossack gets on his horse and rides into the village, is he saying, oh, look at this, the Jews forgot about the Torah, better remind them?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not going through his mind. What's going through his mind is hatred for various reasons I mentioned before. But why does divine providence allow this? Part of it is because of ourselves. That we would probably, there would be so many people who just disappear. We disappear. So we sometimes have to be reminded from external sources, your real name's Abraham. Your real name is Abraham and Sarah. It is not Johann and Wilhelmina, right? It is, right, it's Abraham and Sarah. Right? And your real country is Israel. And, you know, that's something which we need painful reminders of sometimes. So those are the four, I think, correct reasons for the existence of this hatred. Number one is the opposition to our ideology. Number two is the quality of our life and the jealousy that involves. I remember sitting on a plane next to a woman, a black woman, and we were talking for a long time. It was, I think, a 3-4 hour flight, fairly empty flight. She's a Baptist minister. And we had a long schmooze, it was very enjoyable, like 2-3 hours. And she said to me, in the course of the conversation, she said, "I'm really jealous of you." And I said, "What? What are you jealous of?" She said, "Look," she said, "my ancestors came from Africa about 150 years ago to the United States. She said, I don't know what tribe I'm from. I don't know what part of Africa I'm from. I do not know my ancestors' language. I don't know what their religion was. I don't know their stories. What am I?" She says, "I'm a Baptist minister." She said, "That's like a Christian European thing, which was originally started by Jews in Israel. Okay, I say prayers in English. I sing songs written by composers from Europe." She says, "You know, I'm living the life of someone else." She says, "I have faith in Jesus. I believe in this, but there's something that bothers me about that." She said, "You, I see you reading Hebrew. It's a language your ancestors spoke thousands of years ago. I see you saying the Psalms. Do you know what tribe you're from?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a Levite." She said, "Unbelievable." She said, "You even know what who you descended from 3,300 years ago. She says, "I'm jealous of that. The amazing continuity and heritage, which we haven't lost in 2,000 years of exile, which there are people who have lost," she said. "We lost it in 150 years of exile. Gone." There's a certain jealousy. A good friend of mine who converted to Judaism. I mentioned him yesterday. He was a Methodist minister. He became Jewish. He's a rabbi now. As he says, he used to be a rev, and now he's a reb. Right? It was just a dot. Just put a dot in the vape, and that's it. Right? So anyway, but he told me that when he was in school, in elementary school, there were a couple of Orthodox Jewish children in the class, in a public school. And he said he used to always be really jealous. These kids would always have their own lunch. They wouldn't go to the cafeteria. They always take out their little bags with their own kosher food. And they'd always say a prayer before and after. You know, and they'd have their own holidays, which they'd be off. They would just not appear what's going on. It's a Jewish holiday. And there was a certain, he wasn't so much jealous of the fact that food was better or they had extra holidays or anything like that. He was jealous of the fact that there was something special there. There was a certain, something special there was something special about it. Now, but so in many cases, that jealousy, as we said, turns to hatred. But in some cases, that jealousy turns to curiosity and an intellectual quest to see what it is that is special. And those people who that jealousy spurns towards looking into it more, those are people who convert to Judaism. So it's a very, so that's what this woman told me, the jealousy. So, and then we have the otherness, the quality of otherness, our different dimension aspect. And then finally, divine providence to remind us of our role. So what are the solutions? What are the solutions to anti-Semitism? It's very different, yes. Ultimately, the only real total solution will be from God. Right? That the time of the Mashiach, the coming of the Messiah, the time when everyone will recognize that there is a God, that's the only real solution. But I want to point out, just three solutions that have been offered and perhaps some criticism or comments on them. Interestingly enough, some people have suggested assimilation as a solution. Jews have suggested assimilation. There are plenty of Jews who say that if you've got a brain in your head, assimilate, once you assimilate, no anti-Semitism. So they'll say, Hitler looked back 4 generations, you're right, so fine, had we assimilated earlier, he wouldn't have found us. Have we assimilated 7 generations before? There's no way he could have found it. Probably correct.
They would accept it.
Probably from the point of view of assimilation, but the fact is, Jews have assimilated throughout the centuries. The millions of Jews, or the hundreds of thousands of Jews who became Greeks at the time of the Maccabees, is there any anti-Semitism directed against them or their descendants? Yes. No. No. No one knows their descendants are Jewish. The people who married Greeks and who became Greek, right, 2,500 years ago, are they Jewish today? No. They're sitting drinking ouzo on some Greek island, right? No one knows they're Jewish.
The Maranos.
The Maranos,
There are, you know, thousands and thousands of people in Venezuela and Brazil and Spain and Gibraltar are descended from Jews. No one hates them. So now, however, what's the problem with assimilation? A few things. A, we are abandoning our job. We are abandoning our destiny. We are abandoning our identity. We are abandoning our spirituality. It's type of like someone is attacking you, so you say, don't take a step closer, I'll shoot myself. That's a great self-defense technique, isn't it? Right? You take one step closer and I'm going to blow us out of the way. Isn't that what assimilation is? I'm defending myself by committing suicide. Whether it's spiritual suicide or psychological suicide or physical suicide, that is defending oneself by committing psychological, spiritual, and essential suicide. So it's not a solution. Not a solution. And what it does is, as Elie Wiesel pointed this out, someone asked him in an interview, why don't you just assimilate? And he said, Elie Wiesel said, he said something to the effect of, you mean, would you use that as a self-defense technique against a mugger? He tries to mug you, so you throw yourself in front of a car? He says no. So the first point is assimilation doesn't, it means that we're really killing ourselves and we're losing our task, because we have a job in the world. We have a purpose, a unique spiritual purpose. And it is a great tragedy every time that is abandoned. Some people say fight. And there is truth to that, that certainly our obligation is self-defense. You have to have an army. There's absolutely nothing wrong. Not only is there nothing wrong with defending ourselves, it's an obligation to defend yourself. Physical self-defense, having a strong army, absolutely correct. But does it solve anti-Semitism? What does it do? Is it a solution? No. It is a temporary band-aid. It stops the attacks, right? But it does not eliminate it. Has the state of Israel and its army eliminated anti-Semitism? Certainly not. Clearly not. So, it is something which is necessary to fight and to defend ourselves. I'm a believer in that. I was in the Israeli army. And, I'm certainly not against that, but I don't see it as a solution. What is the solution then? Short of the Mashiach, but again along those lines, I think it's the following. The greater the degree of Jewish ideology filtering into the world, the greater the moral level of the world, the less anti-Semitism there'll be. If the world would be a more moral place, there'd be less anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a symptom of immorality. It's a symptom of a lack of spirituality. It is a symptom of the fact that people don't have morality. Right? You don't find, right, the person who is a spiritually sensitive, generous person is not going to be consumed by anti-Semitism. I just want to say, in other words, the fact is that we're not doing our job properly. The job of the Jewish people is to be an example to the world of how to be moral, how to be spiritual, how to be good. And if we would be able to propagate that and the world would see that and increase its own moral level, then there'd be less anti-Semitism. Of course, the total fulfillment of that is messianic, as you pointed out. It's a future world in which we say the world, as it says in Isaiah, the world will be full of the knowledge of God like the water covers the sea floor. A world like that would not be a world in which there's anti-Semitism. A world like that would be a world in which there is going to be peace. Not just anti-Semitism, but there won't be tribal fighting in Rwanda, and there won't be the ethnicity and the fighting because of the ethnicity in former Yugoslavia, and so on and so forth. It's a messianic ideal, but it's something we can work towards. It's something we can work towards. As a great rabbi said, a person thought, I am going to change the world. But he looked at the world and he said, it's too vast, I can't change the world. He said, you know what, I'll change my country. Change my whole country. How can I change my whole country? And he says, you know what, I'll change my city. And he tries, he runs for mayor and he fails. Right? Can't change the city. You know what, I'll change my family. He says, I can't change my family. My parents still look at me like I was in diapers, right? And my older brother looks at me even worse. And I can't change the family. But then, when he decided that he could change himself, that is the key to changing the world. Where the person can look at themselves and start there. And you know what we call this, what's called 6 degrees of separation. Ever heard of that phrase?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
6 degrees of separation is a phrase that claims, and it's probably true, that everyone in the world is separated by everyone else only by 6 degrees. Meaning that if I choose at random some guy out of Bombay, India, Mumbai, pick him out of the street, right, I could probably find a degree of connection of myself to him six degrees. For example, I was in a taxi in New York City, and the taxi driver is an immigrant from India, right, and he is, right, that's one, that's two, right, and this immigrant from India has cousins in Mumbai, right, and the cousins have an accounting firm that does the taxes, right, for the employer of the guy in India that we chose at random. That'd be 6 degrees of separation, right? There is a claim by certain sociologists that you can do that with any two people anywhere in the world. With Jews, you can probably do it in 2 steps. Right? I mean, with Jews, I've traveled widely, Jewish communities all over the world. Usually, I have to go to a maximum of 3 steps to find some type of connection. Oh, you're a rabbi. Oh, he's my uncle. You know, that type of thing. You know, like, it happens, Jewish, what we call Jewish geography, right? But is that idea that there's, and so we believe that if that is so, that there's really only 6 degrees of separation, and in the Jewish world there's only maybe 2 or 3 degrees of separation, right? If I start to change myself, and that has an impact on those around me, and the ripple effect of that can go to the entire world. And yes, it may look like this insane optimistic hope, but I want to tell you that it's an insane optimist would have said 3,000 years ago that we'd be sitting here today studying about Judaism. But you know what? The insane optimist 3,000 years ago would have been correct. He would have been correct. Right? And the pessimist who would have said there's not going to be any Jews then, he would be incorrect. And so therefore, ultimately, that's the solution. As you said, yes, the Messiah, yes, from God, but it's got to start with ourselves. That's where it's got to start. Okay, and that's what we have to do, and that's really the message, I think, of anti-Semitism is do our job, not just half-heartedly, not half the way, not partially, but do it really well and work for our own tikkun, our own perfection, and through the perfection of the self, we'll bring the perfection of the family, the perfection of the city, and so on and so forth, to the extent that, yes, we believe that the whole world will reach that state of perfection, has the potential for that, and can do that. It's only a question of, as it says in the verse, it says, God says, return to me and I'll return to you. And the Jews say to God, you bring us to you, we'll return. God says, no, you've got to start. The whole purpose of there being a world is that it has to start from the human, not from God. So God says, how much has to start from the human? He says, open up an opening like the eye of a needle. And I'll open up an opening like the doors of a banquet hall. So, yeah, he only wants from us eye of a needle. So open up a little bit, start something. And he will then turn that into the doors of a banquet hall in which everyone can rush into the Viennese table. So that's it for today. Thank you very much. And we'll see you.